Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Law enforcers are weighing in on a proposal that could add first responders to Florida's hate crime law.
And I will steadfastly support adding this to the hate crimes list. I think if you target a first responder, you should have the book thrown at you, plain and simple.
Also this week, law enforcement officers are turning to anti-bias training to uncover prejudices against minority communities, that program forcing hard conversations about communities of color and police.
There are folks out there that would say, hey, listen, we don't need to be talking about things that happened 70 years ago and so on. And I say that those people are wrong.
We'll also get an update on how close Florida may be to having a certain strain of medical cannabis oil available for young seizure patients, and we'll meet the new president of the Florida Bar. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Members of the law enforcement community are weighing in on a so-called Blue Lives Matter Act that may be filed in the 2017 legislative session. As Sasha Cordner reports, the proposal would expand Florida's definition of a hate crime to include law enforcement officers and firefighters, similar to a bill filed last year.
Under Florida law, committing a crime against someone else based on race, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation is classified as a hate crime. So is mental or physical disability or an elderly citizen. But some want to add Florida's first responders to that list.
We've seen an unconscionable move toward ambush-style assaults on these servants that are entirely unprovoked simply because of the uniforms they wear.
That's Lake City Republican Representative Elizabeth Porter speaking back in 2015. She'd filed a measure increasing the penalties for hate crimes committed against first responders, correctional officers, and judges. First responders include law enforcement, firefighters, and paramedics. Porter referred to some chants made by the Black Lives Matter movement at a Minnesota rally last year as an example of why her legislation is needed.
When we hear chants of pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon. When first responders are lured to locations to serve as targets, then we know that this situation is out of control and beyond the pale. The relentless propaganda that has been directed toward our public safety officials has openly encouraged those who would do harm to them to feel justified in doing so. And it's time that we force these hostile criminals to think twice about what they intend to do.
For example, under Florida's hate crime law, a first-degree misdemeanor would be reclassified as a third-degree felony. But during its first House hearing, the Florida Public Defenders Association had some concerns that Columbia County Public Defender Blair Payne at the time said he'd hoped to work with Porter on.
Florida Public Defenders Association is not taking a position on this bill at the present time. We have some concerns with it about enhancing offenses that have already been enhanced.
One of the criticisms of this bill, okay, now we're taking an occupation and making it a hate crime. And people will say, well, that's not necessary, but I think it is. I think if you target a first responder, you should have the book thrown at you, plain and simple.
That's Florida Police Benevolent Association's Executive Director Matt Puckett, who says while Porter's bill died in the committee process, the measure still has value. That's why he says he's encouraged by Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley's pledge to file a proposal doing just that, along with Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby both running for re-election. The so-called Blue Lives Matter Act is in response to the recent Dallas shootings where five police officers were killed. While he appreciates the name, Puckett hopes it doesn't hinder what the bill is trying to do.
You know, I hope that it doesn't turn into that kind of discussion, because I think we're losing the meaning behind not only this legislation, but also the meaning behind what Black Lives Matter stands for and what people are genuinely saying when they say all lives matter, too. I think that that's getting caught up in a rhetoric that is not helpful, and we're talking past each other. So if that becomes a problem, I would hope that we could talk that into a different name.
Similar to Porter's bill, law enforcement and firefighters would be covered under Florida's hate crime law. And Puckett says the proposal, a priority for his group, would mirror a Louisiana law taking effect next month.
It's going to bring a discussion about what's going on in the first responder community. And I don't want to just focus on law enforcement, because I know paramedics and firefighters, along with other medical personnel, feel like they're being targeted too. And I think that discussion needs to be put out there, because I think that people forget that these things happen. And I hate to be so callous, but they hear officers killed in the line of duty. They don't realize that those officers were brought into a situation thinking one thing was going to happen, and then they were attacked, and they were attacked just because they were law enforcement.
For example, Puckett says the bill's inspiration is Chris Smith, a Leon County Sheriff's deputy killed in 2014.
You had a person who wanted to kill first responders, particularly law enforcement, who set his house on fire and then called it in, or had his neighbor call it in, and he waited to ambush officers, and he killed Deputy Smith and shot another deputy, and he ultimately was killed. That was a targeted attack against law enforcement. We've seen others.
But Leon County Sheriff Mike Wood, who's also running for re-election, says he's reserving his opinion right now until actual legislation is filed.
Obviously, it's a very serious crime to attack a law enforcement officer. You know, I'm satisfied that statutorily, that's in place. We earn trust one encounter at a time. And so that's how we do it here at the sheriff's office and statewide at sheriff's offices and police departments. And that's not to say we're perfect, because we're smart enough to know we're not. But the statutes as it relates to attacking law enforcement officers are pretty stiff, pretty serious. And so I just would have to see additional legislation before I had an opinion on it.
Meanwhile, the Florida Sheriff's Association says it won't comment until an actual bill is filed, and the Fraternal Order of Police, at least on the national level, have been trying for years to get a hate crime law on the federal books to include law enforcement. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Here's another story about the sometimes tenuous relationship between communities of color and police. Law enforcement agencies across the state are undergoing implicit bias training to reevaluate the way they interact with minority communities. But what does the training entail? We get an answer to that question from Kate Payne.
Departments are turning to anti-bias training to help officers identify and counteract stereotypes of minority communities. President Obama gave a nod to the approach at a recent town hall hosted by ABC News.
Police departments that are doing the best work are also training their officers not just on shooting, not being good shots, not just on the technical aspects of police work, but they're also training officers about how do we get rid of some of our implicit biases.
Backed by decades of social science research, implicit biases are basically thoughts and feelings that steer our actions unconsciously.
So implicit biases are those biases that we might have, attitudes and prejudices and stereotypes, that either we are unable to report because we don't know about them, or aren't quite aware that they exist.
Kate Ratliff is a psychology professor at the University of Florida, and she runs Project Implicit, an online clearinghouse for the research. One of the most common tools for measuring these prejudices is the Implicit Association Test. It's basically a video game. Subjects sort black and white faces with positive and negative words as they flash across the screen. The idea is people are faster to sort concepts already linked in their minds.
And we use that response time, that difference in how long it takes people to pair positive and negative words with white and African-American faces as a measure of implicit bias or implicit preference for white people relative to black people.
For researchers like Ratliff, the evidence is compelling. University of South Florida professor Lori Friedel developed a program for officers based on these theories.
The key to the training is raising consciousness regarding implicit biases, and also showing through role plays, through videos, through exercises, that policing based on stereotypes is not only unjust, it will make an officer unsafe as well as ineffective.
And business is booming for Friedel's fair and impartial policing program. Departments in Tallahassee, Tampa, and Palm Beach County are on board, and recently the federal government signed up as well. But as of right now, there's no established way to measure the results. Researchers like Ratliff aren't confident that biases can just be trained away. But there is feedback from departments.
So every employee from the chief to the custodian has had the training.
That's Anthony Raimondo, a captain with the Sanford Police Department. The agency adopted the Fair and Impartial Policing Program after the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012. Because of the training, the agency is seeking out positive interactions with the community and not just policing it.
They could go out to the park and play with kids. They can go to Habitat for Humanity and help build houses or go to soup kitchens and feed the homeless. There's countless things that we can do, but we track that in a very formal way, and then we reward the officers for that behavior.
But to bridge the historical divide between police and communities of color, Raimondo says the public needs to address decades-old injustices.
Because essentially we have some unresolved issues just below the surface of many of our communities nationally that are waiting for just one event, like Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin or whoever, to scratch the scab off of that old wound and bring it back to the surface.
In an increasingly connected world, Raimondo believes every department needs to rebuild public trust and legitimacy because, Raimondo says, interactions with police on the other side of the country can unravel relationships at the local level. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Well, if you've been following the spread of the Zika virus, here's some not all that pleasant news today. There are 18 new travel-related cases today in Florida, 6 of them in Miami-Dade, 4 in Orange, 3 in Osceola, 2 in Polk, 1 in Hillsborough, 1 in Manatee, and 1 in Volusia County. The Declaration of Public Health Emergency has been amended to include Manatee County. According to the Centers for Disease Control, symptoms associated with the Zika virus last anywhere between 7 and 10 days. The CDC is recommending women who are pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant postpone travel to Zika-affected areas. Florida has been monitoring pregnant women with evidence of Zika regardless of symptoms since back in January. One reason for the big jump in cases today is that the CDC has released a new case definition for Zika that now includes reporting both asymptomatic and symptomatic cases of the disease. Prior to this change, states reported only symptomatic non-pregnant cases and pregnant cases regardless of symptoms. This change comes as a result of increased availability for testing in commercial laboratories. Still to come on Capitol Report, a Jacksonville nursery is trying to convince a judge it should be allowed to grow medical marijuana, and they've got the backing of the Colorado grower who developed Charlotte's Web.
So we chose them for a specific reason, and if there's anyone on the planet that knows how to do this, I'd be one of them.
Tampa native William Bill Schifino is the newest president of the 100,000-member Florida Bar. The 56-year-old Tampa native spoke recently with Capitol Report's Jim Ash about his agenda for the coming year.
I think there are those that may be angry with the judicial branch. I think there are those that may feel term limits are appropriate in their world. What I don't think they've done is really taken a hard look at what it takes to be a good qualified appellate judge.
And we'll take a trip to the stretch of ocean reefs that lie between Florida and Cuba. Hearings have concluded in a nursery's bid to be the 7th medical marijuana grower in the state. Meanwhile, Nick Evans reports nurseries approved earlier in the process are beginning to harvest their first crops.
It's been more than 2 years since medical marijuana legislation passed the state legislature. Under that measure, lawmakers expected treatments to be available at the beginning of 2015. But just outside a Tallahassee courtroom earlier this month, Holly Mosley explained families are still waiting.
Nothing has come as of yet. You know, we were told January 1, 2015, oil would be available to patients, and we're still waiting. And so I'm here for my daughter and for all the other kids and throughout this state who deserve the same opportunity that kids in Colorado have to try this treatment.
Her daughter Rayanne suffers from intractable epilepsy. Mosley's activism on behalf of her daughter led her to the Capitol, and it also connected her with a Colorado group called Realm of Caring, a nonprofit started by the people behind a low-THC strain of marijuana called Charlotte's Web. Mosley now heads up the Florida chapter, and they partnered with a Jacksonville grower called Loops Nursery.
One of the reasons that Loops Nursery was selected as a partner was because they have greenhouse space. They're ready to go. They can start growing immediately.
Joel Stanley is one of the Colorado growers who developed the Charlotte's Web strain. He says under the partnership, Loops Nursery will be able to cultivate it in Florida.
Trademark, standard operating procedures, everything that goes into the product known as Charlotte's Web, we developed. And so we license it to folks that we believe can do what we do in Colorado and will do what we do the same way we do it in Colorado.
The only problem? Loops wasn't awarded a license by Florida's Department of Health. That's why Mosley and her husband have traveled from Gulf Breeze to Tallahassee, and Joel Stanley has flown in from Colorado. They're testifying on behalf of Loop's bid to get his hands on a license. Stanley's new company, CW Botanicals, likely stands to make good money, licensing Charlotte's Web to Loop's. But he claims the partnership is based on competence rather than profits.
We looked at every nursery in the state of Florida. I don't think we didn't look real hard, real good for infrastructure, for knowledge. And then, of course, you know, we get down into the hearts of people. Are they willing to do what we do? Are they willing to honor the right type of pricing for these families and things like that? We look into all of it.
Whether Loops will join the six other licensed growers is now in the hands of the judge. Meanwhile, Christian Bax, head of the Office of Compassionate Use, says each one of those nurseries has gotten the go-ahead to begin growing cannabis.
All six of the dispensing organizations in the state of Florida have been given authority to cultivate marijuana. The majority of those actually have plants in the ground or growing cannabis at this point.
One of them, Certera Therapeutics, has already harvested its first crop. Once health officials give them permission to begin extracting oil, Certera says they'll have treatments ready in just a few weeks. For families like the Mosleys, it's been a long time coming. But Richard Blau, an administrative lawyer with the firm Gray Robinson, sympathizes with the department's task.
It's tough to create something out of nothing. And when you think about it, what the people that are involved in this issue are trying to do is create an industry in a responsible fashion with appropriate oversight of a regulated product that is inherently controversial, but also is perceived to be of great importance to a medical population that apparently is in desperate need of it.
The current nurseries have a legally mandated timeline. From the point of cultivation authorization, they have 210 days to get to a finished product. That means for two nurseries, treatment should be ready by September, but nursery and health officials are optimistic it could be ready sooner. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
William Bill Schifino, Jr., a 56-year-old Tampa attorney, has just been named president of the 100,000-member Florida Bar. Schifino faces a profession struggling with gender bias, access to justice, and a Republican effort to impose judicial term limits. Schifino spoke with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash.
You were just installed. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
And you have an agenda. Could you describe it for me?
Well, we have an agenda, Florida Bar does, and we have our priorities for the year. First is to continue to make certain that we're doing what we can to maintain the independence of the branch, and what we deal with there are court funding issues, funding for the our public defenders, funding issues for our state attorneys. In connection with that is the Constitution Revision Commission, which is coming up. Actually convenes in January of 2017, and so we've got our eyes on that.
Well, there's a controversial proposal that would have to do with term limits for the judiciary, for appellate judges. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Sure do, Jim. That actually came out of the House of Representatives this past year. They advocated it, but the Senate did not take it up, and we were pleased with that. The Florida Bar is opposed to term limits. We don't think it's in the best interest of the public.
Why not?
Well, being a judge, it's like any job, and it takes seasoning. And when you get in an office, particularly an appellate judge, and what we're talking about here are DCAs in our Supreme Court, we've got many fine judges that are appointed to those benches, in their 40s. And certainly 12 years, and that was the proposal. I don't think there's any term limit that's appropriate. But what you don't want, I really can't think of a reason you'd want your good judges who have the seasoning, have learned, being termed out of office just doesn't make sense for the public.
You know, the Chief Justice has been stressing his concerns about access to justice. I assume that's an issue with you.
Sure is. It is for all of us, Jim, in the bar. And what we want to make sure is that the profession is serving the public, that the civil justice system is accessible to all. And I think last year alone, Jim, our lawyers in Florida donated of their time 1.9 million hours of free legal services, and we'll continue to do that. The access piece is different. Now, that's more of the middle class. And Justice LaBarga, I anticipate and expect in short order we'll have a permanent commission that the chief will appoint.
What can the commission do?
Well, some of the things they have on the drawing board right now are, I'll give you an example. We've got a pilot program right now in Clay County, and that's a portal where a citizen can go to the portal, and depending on their economic conditions, their problems, whatever they may be, this portal will point them in the right direction for them. It may be legal aid. Maybe they can't afford a lawyer at all, but maybe it's not. Maybe there's another way to have their problem resolved, and so that's what we're working on now.
Is there a role for paraprofessionals?
Could be. I mean, that's on the table. That was an idea that percolated from the state of Washington. They're called triple LTs, and what the vision has taken a hard look at that, and certainly the board will take a look at that too and see if that's a way to solve the problem.
Now, your members might be uncomfortable with that notion.
Well, we'll see. So certainly nothing, you know, anything like that, we're going to roll out. And when I say roll out, I mean we would go to the members, get membership input. The process that we have is we're inclusive.
You know, the Young Lawyers Division recently came out with an eye-opening survey, and it found 43% of women in the survey reported some instances of experiencing gender bias.
We knew that that problem still was there, but no one, I think most had assumed it had really gotten much better. We were disappointed with the results of that survey, and so what we're doing right now, in fact, we dealt with it yesterday, Jim, we're going to have a committee, we're going to ask Judge Freeman to be on it, a group of 9 lawyers from around the state, some good quality people. We're going to have them get together and make some recommendations in the next 90 days to the bar as to, okay, what can we do to move the needle? That's not acceptable.
Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash speaking with Bill Schifino, the new president of the Florida Bar. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, can U.S.-Cuba normalization save our coral reefs? On the 4th of July, scientists on both sides of the Florida Strait said, "Sí, señor." Tim Padgett from member station WLRN in Miami sent us this Cuba postcard.
That's what has attracted divers from all over the world to come to Luque and reefs like that in the Florida Keys.
Last week on the 4th of July, Billy Causey took a dozen guests out to snorkel at Luque, a popular coral reef 25 miles east of Key West. Causey loves to do this. He is, after all, Southeast Director for the National Marine Sanctuary Program, part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. On this day, Causey was hosting a group that 5 years ago would have been persona non grata in the U.S., environmental officials from Cuba. They'd been invited to learn more about coral reefs on this side of the Florida Straits and the challenges for preserving them.
One of the reasons that we picked Luque on a 4th of July is that there will be a lot of recreational use. Our colleagues in Cuba are just starting to experience the tourism and divers coming to their area. So they will see what we're working with, and we will better understand what it means to our reefs.
That environmental exchange is one of the clearest dividends to emerge from the normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations. Last fall, the two countries signed a historic environmental cooperation agreement. Its chief aim is to save their coral reefs. Those reefs are a vital infrastructure of marine life, and therefore the multi-billion dollar tourism industries of Florida and Cuba.
Coral reefs have been around for 600 million years.
But around the world, and especially in the Florida Straits, they're dying thanks to climate change and human abuse, from ocean warming and acidification to overfishing and overboating.
A lot of those boats are up on the seagrasses. There's even small...
As the boat neared Luque, Causey pointed to a cluster of party boats harming a coral habitat. He kiddingly warned his guests...
They're here today. They're going to be in Cuba tomorrow.
No, all of a sudden, all of a sudden.
It won't happen, the Cubans told him. But they know it could, especially as more Americans visit the island. So Cuba recently launched a widely applauded effort to preserve a quarter of its coastal marine territory.
What really gave me hope was to see how much attention the Cubans were paying to the health of their resources and that there are ways to get our reefs to rebound again.
The U.S. wants to help. For example, preserves like Cuba's Guanacahibes National Park and the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary are now sister sanctuaries. For once, U.S. and Cuban scientists are learning each other's marine habitats and how profoundly they interact. Carlos Alberto Diaz heads Cuba's National Center for Protected Areas. Without a doubt, Diaz said, this is a historic moment for scientists in both countries. It opens the door to the future survival of these reefs. Both Causey and the Cubans were reminded why when they dived in to snorkel at Luque. They saw majestic coral, elkhorn, boulder, star, and almost 40 other species. Causey showed them signs of coral sickness like black band and white pox bleaching. They also saw big blue parrotfish munching algae off the reef. This is what their pecking sounds like underwater. That's a recording made at Luque 2 years ago. Parrotfish are so important because rampant algae growth is suffocating coral reefs. But parrotfish are being overfished in the Florida Straits. Replenishing their populations is crucial. That's more possible now since researchers can see more clearly how parrotfish and their larvae drift between Cuba and the Keys. Even more important, says Carlos Diaz, is that we're learning from each other how to replant coral, like planting trees in forests. Diaz is actually a forestry expert. Causey had the Cuban snorkel above an underwater nursery near Luque. They saw coral seedlings growing on metal frames anchored to the sea floor. The scientists call them Christmas trees.
I'm anxious to learn what makes Cuba a resilient place for corals as I remember them in the past.
David Vaughn heads the Moat Marine Laboratory in the Keys. He and his Cuban counterparts are trying to transplant coral strains from one side of the straits to the other, which could be a huge step for preservation. A decade ago, both countries might have deemed such scientific activity a form of spying.
They think we're doing espionage, yeah. Today, especially with our friends from the University of Havana, we can do all the coral science monitoring we want.
The fact is, though, U.S. and Cuban scientists started forging this relationship years before their countries normalized relations in 2014. Some might say normalization has aided the scientists, but the scientists might argue they planted the seeds for normalization.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.